Free FM.
Penn Jillette.
Yeah, this is Penn Jillette on the Free FM CBS Radio on a very special Penn Jillette show. We're going to be talking to amazing Randy, James Randy of the James Randy Educational Foundation, probably outside of my family, the most important person in the world to me, person that changed my life the most. Sitting also here with Michael Goudeau, and we have Randy here who is, now you don't like the term debunker.
No.
So I call you the old debunker, but that's just to annoy you.
Yeah, I understand.
But since you're the guest of the show.
You're so good at that.
How would you like to have yourself described?
Well, I dropped amazing some time ago after I left the formal stage and the footlights. So I'm just James Randy, president of the James Randy Educational Foundation of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, if you can handle that.
And it's Randy, RANDI.org. Is that right?
That's true.
Randy.org to find out all about this. And how did you end up as the guru of the skeptic movement?
I don't know. I just sort of slid into it. It needed to be done. The Sylvia Browns and the Uri Gellers and the John Edwards and whatnot that were currently plaguing the market needed to be taken down a peg. Actually, Penn, I started when I was like 14 years of age as a kid, maybe I add that, up in Canada, in Toronto, Canada. I got interested in magic, and I saw right away that the phonies out there, the spiritualists and the people who were reading fortunes and predicting the future, etc., they were using the same gimmicks that the magicians were.
And making more money.
and making a lot more money, yes, that's true. And certainly more than I was at the time. I was working bars and various places of ne'er-do-well. And just barely getting along. But at the same time, I had the certain amount of compassion in me for the people who were being victimized by these folks. And I thought to myself, self, I said, one of these days you'll be equipped, you'll be in a position where you can come out against this flummery and do something about it. And that time arrived quite some years ago, and I've been doing it ever since. I think I often say it's like the average person, certainly everyone at this table, and I hope most of those listening, if you were to see a fellow struck down by a car and the car sped off, what you would do, if you have any humanity in you at all, would be to try to make that person comfortable and safe, remove that person from further danger, and immediately, you know, get some help on its way. That's what I'm doing. I'm yelling for help. I'm alerting people to the fact they've been swindled and they need some help. Now, mind you, if the guy wants to crawl back into the traffic again, you know, into the speeding lane, and that's his own business. I may drag him back the second time, but not the third time.
Okay, that's where the line is drawn. You know, when we pitched Bull's hit to Showtime to do a show that was skeptical, we met a great deal of resistance. It's pretty interesting to me that if you want to go on television and say nonsense, it's an easier pitch than if you have stuff you want to say that you can back up. And I know you've banged your head against that an awful lot. Yeah. Do you find there's any sort of change that people are more open to skepticism now?
Not much. Now, Goudeau said it just a moment ago. It's the money. You chase the money. Look at where the money's going and where it's coming from, and you'll find out what's happening. Look at Montel Williams. Now, here's a well-educated man. Obviously not a dummy of any kind. Mm-hmm. He's very intelligent, well-informed and such. But he has Sylvia Brown on constantly because she's a cash cow for him. The sponsors love it. They don't care whether she's genuine or whether she's hurting people. She's box office. That gets people tuned into the program. Bottom line, they like it. The sponsors like it. So I like it.
Now, this stuff is all I've been talking to you about this for, I guess, 30 years, a little longer.
Easily.
I've been talking about this. So it's I've gone through all these arguments myself. But I think you should talk about, pick either Sylvia Brown specifically or Uri Geller specifically or in general. A lot of people use the argument, and I know the answers to this, but I always love to hear you say it. What damage are they doing? What's the real damage?
Well, I always say that it's the thin edge of a wedge. If you start to believe that maybe the horoscope in the local newspaper has some value and you should read it every day, even if you only read it for fun, something coincides along the way, and you say, wait a minute, maybe I should take this seriously, not realizing that 1/12th of the world should avoid using cologne today.
You know?
you get some sort of the thin edge of the wedge, as I said. It can lead to other things. I have found it's very much like dope as well. You know, that if you experiment with it, you get onto it and such, you can get into hard stuff. And it doesn't happen with everybody, not by any means. But you can get into hard stuff, and that can be the end of the path for you eventually. And it happens with people who will begin with a thing as simple as a horoscope column in the newspaper and graduate from that to spending $700 for a 20-minute reading with Sylvia Brown over the telephone.
Is that what she charges?
Yeah, $700. And most of the reading, now we've got many tapes that were sent to us by people who were rather unhappy with the results because mm-hmm. they didn't get any help out of it whatsoever, and she was wrong, wrong, wrong every time she said something. But what you get on there is the first 10 or 12 minutes of this 20 minutes is the names of your guardian angels.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important data to have.
Sure.
Of course, you wouldn't want to miss that. And things like names that you enjoyed when you were a princess in Nineveh, you know, in Babylonian days or whatever. All of this stuff about former lives. And then she gets down to nitty gritty. But you ask me questions, dear. Pardon me, you ask me questions, dear.
Now, I don't, you know, because I don't have the thin edge of the wedge coming in at all, I don't really even, I didn't read any of the books at all. I don't even know what Sylvia's claiming. Where does she claim she gets this information?
Well, she's doing a reading, the way she likes to put it. It's sort of a drop-in phrase, reading. Mm-hmm. It's like vibrations. They wouldn't know a vibration if you handed them a basket full of them. They really wouldn't know. But they use these terms all the time, and she does what she calls a reading. It really is, well, in the art as we know it, it's called cold reading, and mm-hmm. it's making suggestions, dropping hints, mentioning initials and situations. Like a typical reading by a cold reader will be something like, there's newspaper connected with this because I do see a white print on black and it's rather large. I can't read it, but it is saying something there. There's some names with double letter in the name, like an R or perhaps two S's. I'm not sure. And, you know, there's electricity here. Somewhere there's electricity and flowing water. And, you know, I'm smelling something like oil or gasoline, maybe a solvent of some. And it goes on and on like this for 90 minutes of a tape that they will send you when they do this kind of reading by my mail or whatever, and you have to read some significance into it. Now, later on, when the crime is solved or the situation is resolved in some way or other, the believers will look at it and say, look, there was a double B. She said double S, but a B looks very much like an S, an uppercase, you know, and so she must have known. They try to fit the facts to the guesses. It's the art of cold reading, and by throwing these things out and allowing people to feed on them and encouraging them to fill in the gaps, that's the real art of the thing, because they'll say something like, is there an older man with a B in his name? You answer that, and later on when you reconstruct the thing, you say, she told me about Uncle Bart. You know, well, we call him Bert, but he called himself Bart occasionally, I remember. You know, they fill in all these details mm-hmm. by reconstructing it. And that's the art of cold reading, and that's what Sylvia does.
It also has a lot of the upspeak, right, where you make a statement that could be either a statement or a question.
Yeah,
right?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, you're from a large family.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'm getting this, is a popular mm-hmm. expression. They start out with, I'm getting something very slow-moving, like it could be a train or a bus or even a toy car. And they're looking at you, if they're doing a live reading, of mm-hmm. course, they're looking at you to see your reaction. And if you brighten up at any of these things, they stop right there and let you fill in the details.
And also people that go to these are not doing test conditions. They want it to work, so
yes.
They're very open.
And not only want it, Ben, they need it to work. Well, remember, if you're paying
$700, yeah. Yeah, I need this to work.
You're into it for $700. You need it to work. And people will send me the tapes when I've requested them on my internet connection there. I've said, you know, if you have a reading, you're not satisfied with it, send me at least a copy of the tape. And we've done transcriptions of them. They're so abysmally the same.
Mm-hmm.
The same kind of thing for everybody. She starts out on the same tack and goes along with it, and then she branches off according to the answers that she gets, of course.
But that's the you know, like I've always thought that the more physical manifestations use the tools of magicians.
Yeah.
But I've always thought that the verbal manifestations use more the tools of poetry. Bob Dylan writes a song, you know, I married Isis on the 5th day of May, but I could not hold on to her very long. It's nothing to do with your life whatsoever. Your wife is not named Isis, and you didn't marry her on those days.
Yeah, yeah.
But you immediately take that and condense it and pull out what it means to you and
exactly.
go. So it seems like if you were to take Bob Dylan, instead of claiming, as he always has, he's a songwriter or a poet or an entertainer, he claimed that he was actually seeing into your heart, you'd get kind of the same thing. You know, you have the evil use of magic and the evil use of poetry. You know, it's
wow.
And that's what really breaks my heart, is these things that what you're finding in psychics is you're finding all the beautiful stuff that holds us together and that we share and we should talk about. And somehow it's not enough for the person to just say, well, you know, this is what I feel in my heart. Maybe it overlaps yours somewhat, but they have to bring something supernatural into it.
Yes.
Just like the magic trick isn't good enough, you have to bring something else. Now, you've had a lot of experience with litigation, and you've had a lot of people.
Yeah.
And a few weeks ago on our show, someone wrote in with a really interesting question. And, Godot, I'm going to be looking at you for this because I forget all the names. The boy who was kidnapped for 4 years.
Shoot, I don't remember his name. I'm sorry. I'm blanking on it right now.
Sean.
Now, Sean, his parents were on the Montel Williams show.
Actually, foster parents. But
foster
that's
parents.
True. That's true.
And Sylvia Brown told them
yep.
that he was dead.
That's right.
She said he was dead and even gave some information.
Near
the
a couple of rocks.
Yeah, where he would be
where
found.
He was be, and, where his bike, yeah, you know, his bike yeah. was in a.
That his bike was taken away and sold in a foreign country or whatever.
Dumped in another state, in a garbage
state.
Dump
yeah,
in another
right.
state.
Yeah.
So from a skeptical point of view, she's just throwing a lot of stuff out there, and if she happens to hit, then she's a genius. Now that that kid's been found, well, okay is perhaps too strong a word, but he has been found,
mm-hmm.
and we now know what happened to him in those whole 4 years.
Yep.
Why couldn't the parents sue Sylvia Brown or Montel for emotional distress caused by information that was not correct? Do you know
well,
what I mean?
The same old case, Pat, if they get the right lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if the opposition lawyer isn't as smart as the lawyer they get, that's essentially it, because in a case like this, you'd have to prove some sort of damage. If you prove emotional damage, what are the doctor's bills?
Well, I think, you know, I have kids, yeah. and I think the emotional damage is pretty clear.
Yeah, but
you know,
she hurt me by saying that to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I got kids. There's nothing more exciting than just the imagination, the possibility that could happen. If she said that about my kids, you know, you'd go nuts. I don't know how you're not insane.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
I mean, and that's the people that do say, you know, that these psychics aren't doing any harm. They're just bringing comfort.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is one case where I think anybody would think that that's really doing emotional harm.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way that's bringing comfort. If you want to say that the kid had been dead and she had got, let's say, lucky and the kid is dead, because from her, in her business, that's what lucky would be,
mm-hmm.
Then maybe she gave them some closure earlier. But I don't see what the moral justification, even if she had these powers, even if you don't take the skeptical point of view, if she's going to be wrong that often, what is the price that we're paying for?
Exactly. There is no moral justification for this whatsoever. But I go further than that in a slightly different direction. What about Larry King and Montel Williams now?
Sure. Yeah.
These are horrors in the business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anything will do. They don't care whether she does anybody any damage. They certainly don't care whether she's right. They know the gimmick she's using. They're intelligent guys. They're not fooled by it, but they encourage it.
Yeah, it's and you've been on Larry King several times.
Won't do it
with
again.
Sylvia. You've been on with Sylvia,
oh, yes,
weren't you?
With Sylvia several times, yeah.
But it's always an ambush when the skeptic's on, isn't it?
Oh,
right?
Yes. Well, not only that, when I found out how very carefully the Larry King phone calls that come in are vetted, you know, mm-hmm. they're only accepted if they're the kind of thing that King would like to have asked, and they're people that hate me, you know, this kind of thing. Not only that, but I found out another gimmick, clever gimmick, too. What they do is they put the person on hold mm-hmm. if the question is not wanted, and they leave them on hold for the whole rest of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, their phone line is tied up. Uh-huh. And they're waiting any second at all. Larry may call on me, and I want to be here.
Well, I got to say that we're also guilty of that. We take phone calls.
But we do take ones that disagree with us.
We do take ones that disagree with us. But, you know, in the business of doing a call-in show like that, you have a finite number of lines, and you have people you think you're going to get to, and they are screened. You know, we do screen them just to get rid of nuts, you know, absolute nuts that aren't going to be saying anything. I play harmonica. You get that kind of call. You know,
One chap did get through on the Larry King show with Sylvia by saying something like he wanted to know something about his lost brother who disappeared in Japan or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they put him on and he said, Sylvia, why isn't you don't take the JREF's $1 million offer? Mm-hmm. And, of course, this was throwing them a loop. And I'm sure that Sylvia just ground her teeth. You could probably hear it if you listened to the tape carefully. And then she fumbled around, of course, and said the money wasn't really there. And I'm not a man of God, so she has nothing to do with me, et cetera. Rather poor excuse,
Now, another one of your the people that you've been, at least as long as I've known you, you've been a thorn in his side is Uri Geller.
Who?
And exactly.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But now, what's going on with him in Israel?
Oh, boy, he's having a hard time. The last I heard from, and I've heard from all of the newspapers in Israel, all of the newspapers have been coming down on him for the series he's doing there where he says, that he's looking for a successor. Right. Of course he is. And he's got every lame duck magician from the local magic club, the Israeli whatever society, conjurers or magician society, he's got them coming on the program, and they are specifically instructed not to say that they have psychic powers, but not to say that they don't have psychic powers. So they always they murmur things about Kabbalah and, you know, Indian mysticism. Mm-hmm. And so they give you the hint that maybe they're doing this stuff by the real means.
Have you seen any of these shows, any of the videos?
Yes, I have. And, of course, they're done in Hebrew, so I don't
know. I was heard it was kind of a knockoff of Star Search or
exactly.
American Idol or
exactly.
one of those?
That's exactly. They're borrowing on the success of those shows here, of course. And
Uri's the judge and Paul Abdul. And I don't know. Does he have a panel or is it just him?
No, just him.
And he's just there. And they perform for the camera?
They perform, and everybody applauds politely. And some of them are half good. Most of them are half bad. Mostly half bad. But the way they do the thing, the way they judge it, the way they evaluate it afterwards is that they mustn't say anything about whether the performance is real. And Geller never gives an opinion. Yeah, that's the safe way to go, of course, because mm-hmm. then he does some of his tired old stunts. Because he's only got six tricks in his whole act.
He's
anyway.
Not still doing spoon bending, is he?
Spoon bending and the occasional fork every now and then.
Because if you really had the power... You know, what you want to do is bend silverware.
Yeah, you'd think so.
I can do anything. I think I'll bend a spoon.
Yeah. We got James Randi from the James Randi Educational Foundation. That's randi.org. You should certainly go there and check it out. He has a $1 million prize for certain psychics, if they like Sylvia Brown or Uri Geller, if they can prove they have these real powers. And we'll be back with more Randi. Michael Godot is sitting here with me. My name is Penn Jillette. We're on the free FM CBS radio. Oh, my goodness. This is Penn Jillette on the CBS Radio Free FM. Sitting with me is Michael Godot. And then, you know, we've had Richard Dawkins on the show. We've had Norman Borlaug on the show. And this is my biggest hero, you know. So everything I said about Borlaug and about Dawkins, you can just amplify for how I feel about Randi. James Randi is here. Go to randi.org. That's where you want to start. And being a magician, as you started as a magician, it really interests me that Houdini was a very strong skeptic. Although the new book out, of course, you know, we can't claim Houdini as an atheist. He certainly was a believer. And the new book, have you read the new book, the Salome?
I have seen most of it. I haven't had a chance to sit down and read it studiously. But the major premise about him being a spy and such, I can't accept. And the reason I can't accept is because I know the character of Houdini. And he was dead before I was born. Mm-hmm. You know, he died in 26. I was born in 28, so I didn't have a chance to meet him. Damn. But the point is, he wrote and told everybody everything. He was a blabbermouth. We have all of his letters. We have all of his personal records and such, mm-hmm. all of his notes. And nowhere is anything like this mentioned. And he certainly would have put it in his confidential notes.
Mm-hmm. But the definition of spy then was very, very different.
Well, that's true, too.
You know, but it wasn't a James Bond thing.
No.
It was more like you're going to be in Germany, tell us where the shipyard is.
Yeah, look around.
So, they have some pretty good points. But the part that I had always considered Houdini when he was saying, if anyone can come back from the dead, I will.
Yeah.
To be a statement much like, if anybody can swim the ocean, it'll be me. Mm-hmm. Kind of very clearly, this is impossible, but if anybody can do it, I will. But they seem to think, from a lot of the writings, that he believed in the life after death and did not believe in communication between the two. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, certainly he was disappointed in his efforts, which I don't know how sincere the efforts were after his mother died. He was a mama's boy. There's no question of it. And I'm not detracting from the man's character at all. But he was a mama's boy.
And so am I.
There you go. but his mother died. It was a terrible psychic shock to him. And I say psychic shock, I don't mean psychics, right?
Okay.
But it was a mental shock, an emotional shock to him. And I have an idea that he probably looked around a certain amount among the spiritualists of the day, and they were very popular in his day and thriving all over the country and all over the world, to see whether there might be any evidence there, anything he could use. And, of course, he was immediately disappointed and continually disappointed, the most famous thing being, of course, when his mother came back and spoke English. He had a difference with that because she had never spoken any English at all.
But there's good Berlitz classes in the afterlife.
There you are, yes. But, of course, the excuse on that was, as you probably know, Ben, the excuse was that in heaven, everyone speaks English, which we'd expect to be true, of course, yeah.
Now, there also was a cross at the top of the letter, too, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah, well, you're talking about the Arthur Conan Doyle thing.
Yeah. There was also a cross on the automatic writing.
Yeah, well, this is an automatic writing thing that Arthur Conan Doyle's wife did. What a family this was. The Conan Doyles were weird folks.
Well, yeah, they are very, very, very strange and very gullible and probably very, very damaged by the death of their son. I mean, probably.
Oh, yes, Raymond, that was a terrible shock to Arthur Conan Doyle, no question of it. But he really went off the deep end, you know. A man who was supposed to be so logical, he invented the Sherlock Holmes character. That's ridiculous. Sherlock Holmes was the most logical detective in history, fictional, I'm speaking about now. In fact, super logical. But Conan Doyle had none of that.
Well, didn't he? But he also expected Sherlock Holmes to be considered somewhat of a parody, didn't he? That he wasn't as behind Sherlock Holmes as some of the fans are.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I think that's true, too. Yeah.
But what I wonder about is when I get into magic, and Tony and I first started working, one of the big shocks I found was the magicians who would defend psychics as being just another kind of magician.
Yeah.
And also, and more surprisingly, and I guess I can use his name. He would claim it. He wouldn't deny it. But Jeff McBride and that school of magic. And Jeff McBride is a friend of mine and a good guy. But part of his love of magic is trickery is also the love of the kind of spiritual side of it. And although he does nothing, nothing charlatan, he does nothing immoral.
No.
There is a sense with him of this kind of, we get in touch with the real magic because we also do the fake magic.
Yeah.
And that seems so odd because my love of magic was always the trickery, you know, and where that came from. When you first started... I guess it was PsyCop and the organizations, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. Did you have a different reaction from magicians than you expected?
Yeah, I did. I was rather surprised. Doug Henning, of course, from the very beginning was a woo-woo artist. He believed in everything, anything and everything. And I never questioned about astrology or any such hard pseudoscience.
But he believed he could float, did he not?
Oh, yeah. He wrote me two letters in his life. And one of them says so poignantly that he's working on levitation, and Randy, you'll be the first one that I'll invite to see it when I get it perfected. And of course, I never heard from him back on the subject.
You were.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
But, Doug Henning believes in everything, and it's also arguable, isn't it, that It certainly didn't keep him healthy longer, whether that led to his death. No, but it certainly kept him a little bit away from traditional medicine that might have helped him.
It certainly did. He was very dependent on this, and we know that the Maharishi's people tried to get him to do meditating all day long. But he had medical help that was available. He had a condition that was treatable, and he veered away from that because he wanted to do it by all the old Ayurvedic medicines.
Which, I don't know what that is.
Well, that deals with all kinds of black and red bile that you have in your body and yellow bile and various other things. It's total... What's the expression?
I think it's bull's...
Bull's hit.
Hit.
Yes,
that's,
I believe
that's correct.
It is, yes.
All that stuff. Now, you have had, and it's very controversial, a $1 million prize to anyone that can prove a supernatural claim. Is that right?
It's not my personal money, by the way, just in case you're wondering. No, I don't have $1 million, but the foundation that I represent does have $1 million.
And you have that in escrow, is that right?
I do.
So the $1 million, those people who claim that the money isn't there, what do you say to them?
All they have to do is get a hold of us by any means, telephone, fax, telepathy, tarot cards. They can phone in. They can do anything you want. Send us email, and we will send them a copy from Goldman Sachs of the current state of the account. I believe at the moment it's $1,095,000, so their interest is being paid on it. And we take the interest off the top every now and then to help support the foundation, but it's always a minimum of $1 million.
And you can go to Randi, RANDI.org. And find out all about that prize because, you know, if you can prove this to Randi, the
not to Randi, no, oh, if I'm you sorry. Can prove it, period, to an independent authority.
Okay, to an independent authority. If you can prove that, the $1 million is just the tip of the iceberg.
That's right.
You pretty much got a Nobel Prize handed to you, right?
Exactly.
I mean, anybody that overturns that big a breakthrough in physics... would give you not only the $1 million, but also incredible acclaim in every single thing. Yep. And I think that I know you well enough that you'd be pleased as punch to give that $1 million away.
I would simply, Penn, because it would mean you're paying $1 million to develop a secret about the universe that was hitherto unknown. Something brand new. I mean, to prove that there is life after death or that people can do telepathy or can predict the future, any of these things that these woo-woo artists claim, would be such a breakthrough. It would revolutionize everything we know about the real world, and that would be worth it.
And you have people not get very far in trying, but about how many people do you have try for this in a year?
We've had several hundred over the years, and again, that seems like a simple figure to give you. We've got file drawers just full of the applications, but most people don't go any further than just making the first inquiry, and they can't follow instructions. Penn, you have no idea. The stuff we get.
Is that number two pencil?
No, what they do... We ask that they send us two paragraphs outlining the claim that they're making, that they something they think it can do. Now, in two paragraphs, even long paragraphs, yes, you should be able to do that. But they do 30 and 40 pages of crabbed handwriting on both sides, and we have to sit there and try to figure it out. Now we've gotten to a point where we simply send it back, and now we're also making big changes in the $1 million prize.
Yeah, well, I was in that meeting, and we talked about that quite a bit, but tell people what you're doing with that.
Well, essentially, there are two major changes. First of all, it's not going to be open to everybody freely for just simply applying. They have to have a media presence. Now, that may sound rather stringent, but it means that they have to have some sort of media recognition. Now, I don't mean the local shopping paper or the chiropractic news or some such thing, but it has to be some sort of media recognition. Larry King would do. You know, Montel Williams would do, too, you see. Aha. Uh-huh. A little hint there. Any of that kind of appearance where you've got a media presence, one program would do it. That's the first requisite. The second one is that they have to have some academic
support. They have to
fool
someone before you.
Yes,
what you mean.
Exactly.
fool Montel, fool Larry, then come to us.
Well, that's very easy, of course.
if they can get to them. It's a very low entry.
So they have to have some sort of academic support. And many, many of these people like Sylvia Brown and Uri Geller, have all kinds of academic support. That people, scientists who say that, oh, yes, the real thing because I'm a PhD and you can't fool me. Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, ho, ho.
Why do you have the academic thing in there?
Well, because there will be academics, and I want to get the academics with the same stroke. In other words, if an academic has the guts to come forward and say, yes, this guy is the real thing, as many did with Uri Geller at Targan Putoff.
You have to have both. You have to have both. You have to have both the media and the
academic. You have to have both of them. Now, there are other provisions, too. If another skeptical group that we recognize, and there are many of them all over the world, tests this person, and they pass the test of the skeptical group, and they win any minor prize, or they just win acceptance from the skeptical group, that will do as the first stage of recognition. And if they get, again, it can't be the local shopper, it can't be the sure. local dentist who's...
But you have a list of those on randy.org, randi.org. You can go and find out those groups. And of the people that come to you, and this is a question that I don't care about at all, but it's one of the questions I get asked the most. What percentage, and this is just asking you to blue sky, I'm asking you to make stuff up, what percentage of people that you come in contact with who claim supernatural powers, what percentage believe it, and what percentage are real scam artists?
I think it's the majority, the vast majority, do believe they got the powers, because people like Uri Geller and Sylvia Brown and John Edward don't come anywhere near us. Now, Sylvia said that she didn't accept the prize. Oh, she accepted it on the Larry King Live show, but she said that she didn't pursue it because I'm not a godly person. That would seem to be all the more reason to pursue it.
Absolutely, because you could save your soul.
Yeah, and Uri Geller says he won't do it because he doesn't like me. And there's another reason to do it, don't you think?
And bring you down.
And John Edwards simply says that he doesn't answer critical questions. Duh.
You know, I'm going to start that policy. From now on, I do not answer critical questions. We're with James Randi. It's so hard to not introduce you as the amazing Randi because that's when I first knew you. But James Randi of the James Randi Educational Foundation, randi.org. Also, Michael Godeau, as always. My name is Penn Jillette, and we're on CBS Free FM. This is Penn Jillette on the Free FM CBS Radio, sitting here as so often with Michael Godeau. And we have my hero, James Randi of the James Randi Educational Foundation, the Ghostbuster, I guess you could say, someone who, if you claim to have supernatural powers, Randi would love to know about it. Go to if you can do anything supernatural, just go to randi.org, randi.org. There's all the information there. Go to your local skeptics group, pass that one test. Boom, you're right in, you get $1 million, and you've got, I think that you've got a good chance of turning Randi into a man of God and into someone
easily.
That Uri Geller could like. You know,
that may be too much.
That's the $5 million prize, turning Randi into someone that Uri Geller likes.
And incidentally, the new rules will only apply as of April the 1st.
Okay.
So that all the nudniks out there, the people who say they can fly by flapping their arms and various other things, step to the balcony. Let's see it. Those people can still get in on it up until April the 1st. April the 1st, we put the new rules into effect.
Have you had people with the strength of character to go up to the preliminary test, to have you demonstrate that, and to say, well, I guess I was wrong?
We have had a few occasions of that. Now, one occasion was when we were testing dowsing in Australia with our good friend Dick Smith. And we were in his office, and we had the 11 dowsers there who had just failed miserably in their tests, didn't come anywhere near their expectations. And Dick asked them the critical question. He said, raise your hand, and they were on video at this time, raise your hand if you feel you still have the power of dowsing. And all 11 hands shot up in the air. Because there was obviously something wrong with the way the tests were done. You see, that's the way they reason or fail to reason. But one fellow drew his hand back down slowly, and Dick zeroed in on him and said, you lowered your hand. He said, yes, well, maybe I'm not so convinced now that this is a real power that I have. And Dick chortled and said, wow, we got 1 out of 11. We've never gotten that percentage at all, ever. And I said to him, Dick, relax. You know, I think that within a week or two, he'll be calling us back, and he'll say, oh, it was due to Jupiter was in Sagittarius or whatever.
I don't know. I do have faith in people to turn around and to learn.
Well, this fellow did call us back, and he found out why it was. It was the wireless system that we were using. They put out electromagnetic radiation, which interfered with the dowsing.
Aren't the Australians the one who did the competition where they had any stranger come up and do it? They had people just in the crowd come up and take the dowsing test, and all of the dowsers failed but one strange lady, of course, as you would expect in chance, hit all of the targets, and she became a professional dowser. So it had the opposite effect, I believe, of what they intended.
That was not connected with my organization, Godot.
No, okay, sorry.
Well, one dowser there did, I mean, he made us laugh, and at the same time we felt so sorry for him, because he had a forked stick, you see, and that's the traditional dowser's tool, and he had a little screw-on business at the end where he could put a little vial of petroleum or something like that, which was the substance he was looking for, you see, or a little silver tip and a gold tip, and he had the gold tip on, and he was looking for gold out in this lot, and the rod twitched up and down, and the gold flicked up in the air and fell on the ground. Oh, all the dowsers walked in. Oh, we got to find it. They never found it. It's out in the lot someplace still. And they never found the gold tip to the dowsing rod.
Because of radio waves.
Oh, obviously,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, for $40 you can buy one of those little home metal detectors.
Yeah.
How much is that gold worth? Let's give the address.
But that's electronics, so that's science, so we have to reject that altogether.
So, you know, I have at our show, at the Penn & Teller show at the Rio, we have people come to us fairly often after the show. You know, we're rather open about that, and talk about how they had changed their side. Now, these aren't people who were proponents of this. These are people who were just watching at home. But we do have people that can get information. A friend of mine, Lawrence O'Donnell, says the definition of an intellectual is someone who can change their mind when given facts.
Yeah. Well, no, this happens, Ben. There's no question of that. But not with the believers, with the dyed-in-the-wool believers, the dowsers particularly. They're so convinced, the ideomotor reaction, which is what they're suffering from, look it up on my webpage, you know, is so strong with them that they, I think, cannot be unconvinced of it. There's no way you can do that. And that's based on experience of thousands of cases like this all over the world.
Now, I have read, I believe, all your books. I've read most everything you've written, and I've talked with you for hours, and this question just popped into my head, and I don't think I've ever heard you answer it. What is the biggest thing you ever changed your mind on?
Oh, boy.
What is the deepest belief that you held that you were wrong about?
Hard to say now. I've never been posed that question.
Oh, that may be an essay question. That may be a take-home one. But, you know, my mom became an atheist in her 80s.
Oh, really?
In her 80s. And what pushed her over the top was discussions with the family forever, but also because her church was treating their lesbian minister in a really bad way. And she just all of a sudden, for some reason, that hypocrisy crushed down upon her. And to protect this pastor that they liked very much, she started rethinking and finally just came out in the last 3 or 4 years of her life and said, I don't think there's anything to this whole God thing. And I was just in awe. As I said earlier, you know, I'm a mama's boy anyway. Mm-hmm. I've always been very close to my mom. But the fact that she was able to find something that deep that had been that part of her life and just go, you know, I don't think so. And it was probably a, well, you could look at it as a maybe a 40-year process in talking to me. But the actual process that happened was 2 or 3 weeks. But there isn't like a political point or a point like that that you've kind of shifted on over the years?
Well, I think that it takes a certain amount of intelligence to be able to do this and education to be able to do this, to do a reversal of this kind. But the key phrase is here, it's not that they want this to be true. They need it to be true.
Yeah, talk some more about what you mean by they need it to be true. Because if they need it to be true, then what you're doing is wrong, isn't it?
Well, yeah. But the other aspect of it is this, Penn. If they have to say that they're wrong and they reverse their minds on it, they have to be essentially saying they think, and I don't think this is true, but they think they have to be saying, I'm really stupid. No, naive is not stupid.
Right,
naive and uninformed is not stupid.
And also, victim is not stupid.
That's
true. The thing I always compare this to is,
that's right.
You know, people say how stupid do you have to be to believe in the psychic, and I always say, well, how hot do you have to be raped? You know, you had to be asking for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have a tendency to blame the victim, because if we can blame the victim, then we can say why it's not going to happen to us.
Exactly.
And I think that anyone, and maybe except you, but certainly me, can be duped. You know, can be duped and duped badly.
Oh, no, we can be duped.
And you blame, and you must blame the perpetrator and not the victim. But when you say they need to believe this, you have to explain that more. Because in one way of looking at it, if someone needs something, like they need food or like they need water, and you're coming in and trying to take that away from them, what you're doing is then wrong. So you can't mean need in the traditional sense.
That's true. And another thing, too, I was talking with a colleague of mine quite some time ago, and I just popped up at this question. I thought, that's a decent question to ask him. I said, it was Andrew Harder, as a matter of fact.
Sure.
And I said to Andrew, Andrew, was there ever a point when you believed in all of this crapiola? And that's a technical term.
Sure.
Yes. And he said, he paused for a minute, and he said, no, I don't think so. He said, I can't remember a time when I would have accepted any of this from the time I was a small kid. And I said, now, that's really interesting to me, because it's exactly the same answer I would give. I haven't a moment, Penn, that I can think of as a child or as an adult ever that I would have believed any of this sort of thing, any more than I would have believed in Santa Claus. Because that was totally illogical to me from the moment I first heard it. And I just skipped right over it immediately and knew that it was a myth.
I remember reading Chariots of the Gods and believing the UFO stuff when I was about 10 or 11. I read that book and believed it.
I was totally into the Carlos Castaneda stuff. I mean, I didn't really believe it, but I really wanted it to be true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another point. I don't have any need or want. The thing people say, do you want it to be true or not? I don't care. All I want to know is it true? Yes or no? I want to know what the truth is, and I have no fear of the answer. Mm-hmm. Someone might come along, Pat, you know that. Someone might come along who has this mysterious power. I don't think it's going to happen, but someone might come along. If that's true and they can prove it, I would simply sigh and say, damn, all this time, I've been spinning my wheels. There was such a thing. Wow. And I'd give them $1 million at the same time.
And then go hang with them. Because
they
were rich.
Dinner's on you.
Yeah,
dinner's
I better hang
you.
With
let's
them.
Go out, let's, yeah. go out, let's go out and celebrate. You know, that's really interesting that you never had. Did you have, were you religious as a kid?
No, never religious.
Never religious? Not your parents weren't at all?
Not at all.
Yeah, because I went to church. You know, right. I was baptized. I'm the, first Congo, first Congregational Church of Greenfield, Mass. And I was a believer in, I think, all sorts of stuff, probably up until I was 16, 17, around there.
Well, you know, my mom went to Catholic school, and that beat it out of her. A lot of people who are atheists went to Catholic school.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a good friend whose name I guess I better not say. I have a very good friend who considered seriously, and he claims he wasn't kidding, sending his daughter to Catholic school because he thought that they made the best atheists. And he thought that she should be sent there and see that whole other side, so she'd have those arguments for the rest of her life, all being able to be taken care of. So our guest today is James Randi. You should check out the website. If there's a website that can give you a huge amount of information about a whole subculture very, very quickly, it's Randi, RANDI.org. ORG, the James Randi Educational Foundation. And if you would like any of the stuff Penn and Teller do, or any of the stuff that we do on our Showtime show, Bulls Hit, it all starts with Randi, so go check it out. And next year you're going to be doing another TAM, The Amazing Meeting.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah. They're getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Was it over 800 people this year?
It's going to be 800.
Holy
and
moly.
A little more.
Okay. when all the counts are in. This is Penn Jillette, Michael Godeau, and my hero James Randi on CBS Radio Free FM.
Check Penn Jillette weekdays on Free FM.